From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Dan Raviv, national correspondent for Israeli-based I-24 News. Our moderator is CBS Radio contributor Michael Williams.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. The tensions between Turkey and the United States continue to escalate on multiple fronts, as each country imposed additional tariffs on the other, and a disagreement over the fate of an American pastor imprisoned in Turkey since 2016 remained unresolved. The closely watched trial of former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort went to the jury for deliberation, and the verdict could give a strong indication of how the ongoing investigation of Russian interference by Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller will proceed, and for how long. President Trump revoked the security clearance of John Brennan, a senior intelligence official in the George W. Bush and Obama administrations who has been a vocal critic of President Trump. Despite administration claims that the action was taken because of Brennan's, quote, erratic behavior, unquote, subsequent statements by President Trump raised questions about the real reason for the revocation and about who could be next. Another round of primary elections in the United States confirmed the popularity of President Trump among Republicans, but polling and popular wisdom still point toward a Democratic takeover of the House of Representatives in the upcoming midterm elections. And we take a moment to remember an icon as Aretha Franklin passes at the age of 76. So, Dan, I have an open template for when I moderate this show, and it goes, the Trump administration has imposed new sanctions on fill in the blank. And you get plenty of use for this one. This week, the focus is on Turkey, where there have been another round of sanctions that have gone back and forth, trade sanctions, tariffs, and so forth. In this particular case, it seems to be a bit of a mismatch when you're talking about how these will affect and what the possible outcome is on the economic side. But I'd like to get to the root of the real dispute between the U.S. government, the Trump administration, and Turkish President Erdogan. What's the real root of this?
Michael, in this case, it's not officially sanctions, but tariffs. Looking at Turkish exports, steel and aluminum were the first targets, and a lot of Americans don't know that a lot of steel rebar, it's the reinforcing steel inside a building, inside a bridge, you put the concrete over it. Most of America's steel rebar comes from Turkey. That was a surprise to a lot of people. And now there's a tariff of 50%, double what it was before, and also a tariff on aluminum products, 25% from Turkey. And the president announced that, you know, with kind of great enthusiasm that we're taking action. Because you're right, he likes to take action in a money-related way. Right, as a longtime businessman, as a billionaire, you know, that's the way he thinks. And he wanted to put pressure on Turkey specifically because there's an American who's been under arrest there now for 2 years, Pastor Andrew Brunson, right? A Christian pastor in Izmir, Turkey. Now, this is as far as the Turkish government went. At the request of the U.S. government, Brunson was allowed to go home. He's under house arrest, but he's not being allowed to leave Turkey. And the president, and especially Vice President Mike Pence, who's close to a lot of Christian activist groups here in the U.S., they really care about Brunson, and so they announced the extra tariffs to put pressure. And then President Trump now has tweeted that he considers, quote, our wonderful Christian pastor to be a great patriot hostage. So he's claiming that mostly Muslim Turkey is holding a hostage. This is very emotive language. It means that President Trump is trying to whip up Americans to care that a mostly Muslim country is keeping a Christian hostage. And you have to wonder, what was it that President Recep Erdogan of Turkey did that angered President Trump so much? And you start going down a list that President Erdogan has been very anti-Israel, that President Erdogan has wanted to stay inside Syria, putting pressure on Kurdish forces who are supported by the U.S.
Correct.
And there's even more than that. Erdogan is buying a lot of military equipment from Russia rather than buying from the United States, despite Turkey being a member of the U.S.-led NATO alliance. So there are a lot of issues. And then it seems that President Trump heard about Pastor Brunson and decided to make him the pressure point. It shows a big falling out between the U.S. and Turkey.
Well, when we look at the effect of what these tariffs have been, the Turkish lira took a very hard tumble. I think there's been some recovery at this point. But again, it seems like a bit of a mismatch when you talk about matching the ability of the U.S. to impose economic pressure with the ability of Turkey to withstand it, even insofar as the Turkish economy was certainly under pressure anyway from this high rate of inflation. There's been a lot of borrowing that's gone on to sort of pump up the economy in this populist style of government that Erdogan has been running for the past 10 years.
Normally, the American government, Michael, would stay out of that. But the Trump administration has mentioned it almost with glee that Turkey's economy is already weak, that the lira was already in trouble. And now this, caused by American pressure. So again, what's the pressure for?
And but does the collapse of the Turkish government, the Turkish economy, does that really serve the United States? Again, pointing to a NATO ally and a key NATO ally.
Well, let's put it this way. The Trump White House looks at certain countries, including traditional allies, certainly even in Western Europe. And if President Trump disagrees with someone, say Chancellor Angela Merkel in Germany, where President Trump publicly says that Germany shouldn't have allowed so many refugees from North Africa and the Middle East to come in, and that Germany made a mistake. And again, it almost feels like a personal reaction. But as a reporter, you ask people in the Trump administration, what's this about? And they start dressing it up with more policy analysis. Just talking about Germany and refugees, and some of this would apply to Turkey as well.
Right.
They then think about it deeply and they say, you know, it does affect the United States. Because if there's going to be, for instance, more of a terrorism threat in Europe, that's going to affect U.S. interests, American travelers, American investments. And so to that extent, you know, Washington, D.C. is now saying, we are involved in all those countries. Again, traditionally, we wouldn't get involved in criticizing Turkey's economy. I think Trump would welcome President Erdogan being weakened. At first last year, in his first year in office, President Trump tried to be friendly with Erdogan. And that's,
I think you saw him as a kindred spirit in the terms of the strongman populist type of leader that he generally towards to gravitate.
That's true. To. President Trump usually does like that kind of leader. But you noticed President Barack Obama liked him as well, thinking that Erdogan might be a breath of fresh air in the Middle East. He's not Arab, but he's Muslim. And coming from the NATO alliance and wanting to be part of Europe, Turkey could be a positive influence. But really, the Trump thinking about Erdogan is, we're fed up. And so I'm not saying the U.S. is trying to install an alternative government, but certainly the Turkish pro-Erdogan media are accusing the U.S. of that, intervening, putting pressure as though the U.S. wants to get rid of Erdogan. I think that accusation is too strong, but you can see why these feelings get whipped up.
Final thought on the subject. You mentioned the connection between Russia and Iran as to potential stronger partners for Turkey should relations continue to deteriorate with the United States. That's been posited that these would be strong alternatives for Turkey in their quest to solidify, bolster their economy, and then going forward and building a bridge towards the east rather than towards the west. Is there any realistic possibility of that happening? Given the fact that NATO still is the overarching relationship that connects Turkey with the West.
Yeah, isn't it fascinating, Michael, that even when a country is a lot smaller than the U.S., certainly with a much smaller economy, it still has choices. And it can wield that as a kind of political weapon where, again, Ankara, Turkey can look toward Washington and say, you know, we talked to Moscow and Tehran.
It reminds you of the old Cold War, doesn't it?
We could have other power centers. Every small country can say that. The feeling of confidence in the Trump White House, in the Commerce Department and the Treasury Department that are in charge of tariffs and sanctions, is that Turkey won't be able to take it. At the very least, there's a prediction here by the U.S. government that Pastor Brunson will be released. If that occurs, you think relations will be healed immediately? I don't. There's a lot of bitterness from this.
There is a lot to overcome at this point. Let's move to another topic, which is the trial of former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort. The trial is gone as we speak to the jury for deliberation, and we await that. It was a trial of note in Washington, D.C., as any federal trial of this level would be. There were some very interesting happenings that happened that were I think it's unusual in this type of trial. You're very good at breaking down the players for those who don't know them. So could you give a quick summary of the players in this one and where we stand at this
point? Well, sure. And a lot of listeners around the world may wonder what's the big deal about the Paul Manafort trial. And then they pick up that for 3 months in the year 2016, Manafort, who was a political expert, a consultant to campaigns around the world, in the U.S. and in foreign countries, Manafort was hired by Trump to be the chairman of the Trump for President campaign at a time that the campaign wasn't going well. And Manafort was quite a success at the Republican Party convention. And everyone knew, everyone in politics knew that Manafort had worked for Russians or for some Ukrainians, turned out to be Ukrainians linked with Russia. And people wondered about that, but it turns out that the special prosecutor who was looking into possible collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia discovered that Manafort had had bank accounts overseas, that he had made tens of millions of dollars from his political consulting work, mostly in Ukraine, did not report it on his United States taxes, had foreign bank accounts that he did not report. Those were the basic charges. So bank fraud, in which he applied for more loans in this country based on income that apparently was made up. Okay, all of that, but nothing to do with what Manafort did for Donald Trump. So why did the special prosecutor, Robert Mueller, start this criminal case? There's one trial that's been going on in Alexandria, Virginia, and another trial, separate charges, that Manafort did not register as a foreign agent in Washington, D.C. That's supposed to start in about a month. This is putting pressure on Manafort. And so we have to conclude that Mueller, who never speaks to the press, we don't know what's on the special prosecutor's
mind. Not even through proxy does he speak to the press.
No, he really doesn't. And but he sure appears to be putting pressure on Manafort, probably hoping that Manafort will testify against others, maybe even against President Trump or members of his family. We don't know if there is anything to testify about. Manafort has remained silent, didn't testify at his own trial. And Michael, that leads to the conclusion that he probably is hoping that President Trump will pardon him. The President of the United States has the absolute right to pardon someone of any federal, national crime. And so maybe that's what Manafort's hoping for. That, if so, that plan is a secret as of now, Michael.
We're going to take a break right there. And when we come back, we'll get to more issues in just a moment.
Here's a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News on the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook, Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Dan Revive, national correspondent for Israeli-based I-24 News. Our moderator is Michael Williams, CBS radio contributor.
Back to the issues. Dan, John Brennan, a former CIA director, who is now a commentator for a national news network in the United States, this week was stripped of his security clearance by the Trump administration. It's an action that the president had publicly considered for some time, but many thought, and including House Speaker Paul Ryan, publicly said that he thought that he would never actually do it, but he actually did it. Let's see where to begin. The initial statement about the action, as we alluded to in the opening, was due to John Brennan's, not only the content of his opposition, but maybe the style of it. Can you comment a little bit about what he's done for those who haven't heard John Brennan and what he said about the administration?
Yeah, Michael, as you said, the White House said that John Brennan has acted erratically, right? And that's
erratic behavior.
And that's a reason to take away a person's security clearance first. What is security clearance? It's the right to get classified information, to see classified documents. Everyone will understand that the head of the intelligence agency, the CIA, has a top secret classified clearance, and probably the highest form. And so he had that as CIA director.
And let's be clear, running around Washington, I mean, you can't swing a briefcase without hitting a person who has high-level security clearance.
I've heard there are 3 million Americans who have some level of clearance.
It's a very, very common thing to have security clearance. They're members of my family. I have at some point also.
Because you might have been hired for a project where you'd come in and maybe consult with the government, and so you had to have clearance to see like anything.
What I was getting to is that it's a part of how you work in the nation's capital and for the government apparatus outside having a government position.
That's worth saying. But, Michael, it's probably true that the CIA director had an even higher level of clearance than you.
I would guess so.
You'd hope so.
I would hope so.
Well, but some of those people after Donald Trump became president, some of the people who had those kind of jobs, CIA, other intelligence agencies, sometimes even veterans of the military, have been open critics of President Trump. He's an unconventional president. He's so different. And so the kind of person like John Brennan, a career in counterterrorism and in the CIA, a senior advisor to Barack Obama in the White House and then his CIA director, traditionally when a person like that retires from government and then probably gets a job in the private sector from some companies, consulting, maybe being a TV pundit, they usually remain nonpartisan. That was their whole career. But there's something about the Trump presidency that made people like John Brennan and some others who had jobs like that in the CIA and other agencies become public critics of Trump, not just going over his policies, but about a month ago, looking at Trump's meeting with Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, John Brennan, former CIA director, said Trump's behavior was treasonous. One other thing, when it comes to Trump's claim that there was never any collusion between his political campaign and Russia, Brennan has described that as hogwash. Is that Brennan abusing his access to classified information? Does he know Russia did something? Or is he just giving his opinion? You can see why the White House got angry at him, Michael.
They've been angry with him for quite some time. They've been angry with him since early on in the Trump presidency when President Trump was on the attack on the intelligence community, saying that the entire investigation was a witch hunt and so forth. You've alluded to all the terms.
Well, you're right, but the intelligence community had concluded officially on the record,
correct,
Russia meddled in the U.S. election trying to help Donald Trump. That angered Trump from the beginning.
From day one. So given that fact, and I think that every report has said that the action taken against Brennan has been considered for some time, weeks, maybe months, why now take that action?
It does seem like the White House is good at what you could call a distraction game.
Okay. Distraction from?
Well, there's a former Trump aide, an advisor. Her name is Omarosa Manigault Newman. Omarosa, very famous in the U.S. She'd been on reality TV shows like The Apprentice, the one that was hosted by Donald Trump, in which you either got hired or fired, and she was fired several times. But she was usually the evil one, and so she had really quite a following. And then President Trump gave her a job in the White House in the Office of Public Liaison. And in deciding what salary level she'd be at, she was at the highest level for a presidential advisor, $179,000. A year in the White House, and then they soured on her, didn't like her behavior. The White House chief of staff didn't like her, so the chief of staff fired her this past December. She was obviously angry from the beginning and started saying she's working on a book. She appeared on another reality TV show or two, so people wondered what's up with Omarosa, but you started to forget her. But her book came out this past week. And in publicizing her book, she started playing audio recordings that she had secretly made. One has President Trump on the phone telling her, oh, I didn't know you were going to be fired. I don't like that at all. I feel bad about it. But she even played the audio tape, the audio recording, of her being fired by Chief of Staff John Kelly. Again, secretly recorded. Now, a lot of people think that's bad taste, but if you know anything about Omarosa and her career, that's no surprise. But it also sets her up as an enemy of President Trump. So this became a really big subject in Washington, nationwide. She's famous. Recordings are being played. And so you could say that the White House wanted to come up with a new subject. I mean, the memo that they issued, that the president decided to take away the security clearance from John Brennan, former CIA director,
yeah,
though it came out the other day, it's the middle of August, was dated July 23rd. They had that piece of paper ready.
And to come back to Brennan and the action that was taken, there have been talks about others who will be considered for similar action. The names include Sally Yates, Andrew McCabe, James Clapper. These are familiar people, former directors or former senior officials in the FBI and other intelligence agencies. Simple question. Is there an enemies list? And is this how the enemies are being punished?
Well, of course, it might not be on paper. It might be in the president's mind, the people whom he's seen on TV and he doesn't trust, and they seem to be enemies to him. I think we clearly have a president of the United States who labels people right away as being pro-Trump or anti-Trump. When he goes out and leads political rallies in any state, he is showering praise on any politician, on any candidate who's been, quote, good to me. He was so good to me. That's important. And foreign leaders know that, right? Anytime a foreign leader has met with President Trump, they know to shower him with praise because then Donald Trump's going to like you more. And so these former officials like James Clapper, who used to be the director of national intelligence under Obama. Or Michael Hayden, who was the CIA director and director of another agency, the National Security Agency, under President George W. Bush, big part of his career. They've been critics of Trump, and Trump said, oh, they're enemies. And not only that, they're the ones who helped start the Russia collusion hoax investigation. So, yes, that's bitter. And he may well take away their security clearances, too.
Again, that's a basket of people who fall into that category as of having been involved at the beginning of these investigations and literally painted with that brush.
Well, therefore, there might be a reason that the White House legitimately sees them as an enemy or as trouble, or they shouldn't have access to secrets at any level, or it is what you said, a Richard Nixon-style enemies list. That's all part of the controversy now.
That is, depending on how you see it, your point of view on this one, for sure. A couple of quick hitters as we go out. There were more primaries this week. There were congressional primaries, I believe, in Minnesota and Wisconsin. There was a Republican gubernatorial primary in Minnesota, I believe, if I got that right. And I just saw a few puzzle pieces falling into place for me there. And maybe you can comment on my comment. I believe that the winners on the Democratic side sort of confirmed that the quote-unquote preferred candidates of Democrats are tending to win in these primaries. The safe favorites tend to win. There's definitely a tendency towards diversity. We're seeing women and even transgender candidates winning in Democratic primaries.
There are now two Muslim women who are the Democratic Party candidates for their congressional seats in Minnesota. And that's a breakthrough.
Right.
But I think you're right, Michael, that Democrats who label themselves as socialists, Bernie Sanders style, they're not doing too great. Though it depends where you are. There's, of course, one who famously in New York is doing well.
Exactly. And another confirmation is that in primaries, certainly, Republican candidates that give a big hug to the Trump administration tend to do well. Whether they need to soften that hug or even make a push off to win a general election remains to be seen.
But and that has to be clear, I think, to all the listeners, right? A primary, which just occurred, is within the party.
Correct.
So Republicans really like President Trump, and so they stuck with him. But in November, when it's a Republican against the Democrat, Republicans may behave a little bit more distanced from Trump.
Which is not unusual for party candidates to run towards their extreme in a primary and run back towards the middle. It's maybe just a longer run back to the middle these days. And Tim Pawlenty was interesting to me, a former governor of Minnesota who ran in the primary, lost to a candidate who was a big supporter, who is a big supporter of Donald Trump.
Pawlenty not pro-Trump enough for the current Republican feeling.
Oh, he was one of the first to really say that he was a never-Trumper. You could say you could put him in that in that category. His quote is, "The Republican Party is Trump's party now." Quite simply, is he right?
Yes, but November could change things. If the Republicans do very badly in the race for the House of Representatives, if the Democrats capture a majority in the House, the whole tone of things here in Washington will change. Every committee of the House of Representatives would be controlled by the Democrats. Just imagine what the hearings will be. Just imagine what the subjects will be. It really makes a difference. November 6th is our election day in the U.S. The result's going to make a difference.
We'll have a lot to talk about.
Sure.
Leading up to and after that time, I just want to take a minute or two before we close to recognize legendary singer Aretha Franklin, who died at the age of 76. She was known as the Queen of Soul, and her career spanned over five decades. And she touched the lives, and I believe indeed changed the lives, of all that heard her. Respect, perhaps her best known song, became an anthem for both civil rights and women's rights activists. She performed for kings and queens, for presidents and popes. I think it's remarkable that she sang at Dr. Martin Luther King's funeral and at Barack Obama's inauguration. To me, that's the bookends of a couple of the bookends of my life and my experience. She's on the soundtrack of my life. I'm sure same for you, Dan.
And beyond civil rights, beyond African-American causes, I wouldn't want anyone to think that Aretha Franklin was limited to that. First, Aretha Franklin wasn't limited to anything.
Mm.
And even if you didn't think you liked gospel singing or soul music, oh, yes, you did once you heard Aretha just open her mouth and sing. I heard her at a Harvard University graduation. And so institutions of at every level in the U.S., mostly white, mostly black, mostly anything, were so delighted if they'd have a chance to have Aretha Franklin, what she represented, and, of course, more than anything, to have her sing. So even on a newsy program like this, Michael, I think we should hear her sing.
I think so. I had a chance to meet her one time. I get goosebumps even thinking about that moment when I had a chance to meet her. And That is all the time we have. But as we close, it would be lovely to hear some of the strains, maybe from my favorite tune, which is Natural Woman. Thanks to Dan Revive, national correspondent for Israeli-based Channel I-24 News. This program is produced by VOA's Current Affairs. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites, and I'm Michael Williams, CBS Radio contributor. Thanks for listening.